Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, June 11th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And this week, we have a wonderful chat with a writer named Angela Garbez, who wrote a great book called Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. I cannot believe that this is, I think, in 4 years, the first time we've talked about this topic. What? Anyway, before we dive into it, I do want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, it is and will always be 100% free to download. And the way that I can keep that going through all of the work that I do, along with the editors, that the incredible editors that work on the show, along with my assistant, is through the support of listeners. Listeners like yourself. So, you know, I think that the easiest way to support the show is through Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/talknerdy. Read about it. It's really cool because you can support a lot of other content creators at the exact same time. And it's a really great community and service that really supports community. This week, the top supporters are Rob Schreck, thank you so very much, as well as Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and of course, Jeffrey Sewell. And now remember, there are a lot of other ways that you can support the show. Just visit my website. It's carasantamaria.com, where you can find all the newest episodes and you can find links out to Patreon and to the store. But let's not take too much time at the top because this is such a fascinating chat. And it's a topic that, just because I don't have kids and I don't plan on having kids, I think it does touch all of our lives. A, we were all born to somebody, right? And B, many of you listening have children, or you know somebody who has children. You have family members with young kids, you know, whatever the case may be. So again, her book is called Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. It's available anywhere that books are sold. I highly recommend you add it to your list. So without any further ado, here she is, Angela Garbez. Well, Angela, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Kara. Thank you for having me.
Of course, I'm so excited to talk about your new book, Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. And of course, usually when you write a book, it takes quite a while. So I'm a bit confused because when I emailed you recently, I got a vacation responder that said you're on maternity leave. Is this your second?
Yes. So okay. I've spent a lot of the last year gestating, both a book and a baby. And I had my second baby 2 months ago.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay,
yeah, so I mean, it's ironic because I'm doing a lot of work these days to promote the book when in my heart of hearts, I believe also that I should just be on family leave. But you got to take opportunities when they come and you got to run with it. So,
well, the good news about doing this kind of freelancy remote interviews and things like that is you get to do them from home. So you may as well, you probably have a baby in your lap right now. And I think that's wonderful.
She's not actually in my lap, though I can hear her. It's helpful that I have headphones on. I can hear her just down the hallway.
Oh, good.
She's being well taken care of. She's fine without me for an hour.
Oh, sweet, sweet. Yeah. My baby dog, because I do not have children, he is incredibly needy while I'm recording. So he may or may not jump into my lap at some point.
Oh, okay.
But that's the great thing about podcasting. So I'm really excited about this because I feel like this is a topic that it's a bit alien to me, but it's also super important to me. On the show, obviously, we focus on science, but I am a big advocate of having conversations about feminism, multiculturalism, intersectionality. And it's so strange to me that I've literally, in the 4 years I've been doing the show, never talked about pregnancy more than just me saying, I don't want to ever be pregnant.
Yeah, well, I mean, thank you for saying that, because until I wanted to become pregnant and until I became a mother, it wasn't a topic, you know, pregnancy wasn't a topic that I engaged in on a scientific level. It was very much more theoretical. And it feels, I understand, it feels removed from your life or from your daily life. And that totally makes sense to me. The thing that I would say, though, is after having done all this research, I think there's a strong case to be made that even just having some basic knowledge around it from a science perspective, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's very complex. It has wide-reaching implications. And the other thing is, it's in fact relevant to everyone's life, whether or not we think that way or not. You know, somebody got pregnant and gave birth to you.
Yeah.
That's true of everyone. We all have a mother. We were all born. We've all directly experienced pregnancy and birth. So.
Absolutely. And like, even if, you know, I don't want to have children. I'm 34 years old. I am right at that core age where a bunch of my friends are having children. Actually, one of my very best friends, literally, I think it was 2 weeks ago, gave birth to her second child. And I was there 2 days after the baby was born.
Oh, that's a very fresh
It was a thing. Fresh little nugget. And it was so sweet. I got to hold it. Its head was still kind of weird shaped. And I was God.
I call newborns, they're really more like organ bags or skin sacks. You know, they're not. My daughter, my second daughter is now, you know, 2 months old, and her personhood is beginning to emerge, but they're really, they're just sort of blobs up until, you know, after a few weeks. You're really just, they don't give you much.
And there's so much, I mean, so obviously my lens of pregnancy comes through good friends of mine who have had kids. And because I'm lucky enough to be kind of in a science community, these babies are always mini science experiments to all of my friends. And they, when I come over, it's just hours and hours of fascinating conversation about weird stuff you never knew about having kids. And that's why I think your book is just so fascinating, because like you said, it's relevant to all of us because we've all been born. We all know somebody who's being born at any given time.
Yeah. I mean, the human species, we are continuing. We are still here. And that's because people keep reproducing. And I think it's great, you know, that people have choices. You should not reproduce if you don't want to, but it's happening. And so let's talk about it.
And it's like a thing that we have evolved. I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing that we evolved this capability to do. So whether we have a kid or not, there's stuff in our body that's like, this is how I'm going to help you make a baby. And knowing about that, I think, is really important, especially for men. I'm going to be honest, especially for men who are like, I don't understand that they're plumbing. I do think it's important to get into the science of how this stuff works.
Yeah, I mean, for men, I'm like, whatever. You know?
I love it.
I'm like, they're not my primary audience. I think if men want to educate themselves, great. You know, but it's also just, you know, you grew up in a uterus, a vagina and a clitoris embraced you. They were your first neighbors. So, you know, if you don't want to engage in that, fine. But it's still, you grew up very close to these things. These are, were there with you at the beginning of life. So that their plumbing made it possible for you to be around in the first place.
And of course, that their plumbing is important to understand. And so you really talk about a lot of different things in the book. I like that you have a very kind of feminist, I would say progressive sensibility throughout the book that I think is really important for a lot of women, especially in a day and age where they don't always get to read this kind of literature. It's important to have that perspective. But you also talk a lot about not just the science, which is important. This is what's happening. And that's, you know, it's been done before. Like, we know a lot of things about the science of pregnancy. There's a lot of woo out there. There's a lot of pseudoscience, but the culture around pregnancy.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that the two are really related, you know, and that's one thing that I realized. I mean, I don't have a hard science background. I was an English major in college and, you know, somewhere along the line after I took biology and then struggled in chemistry, I, like many women, like many young women, decided that I wasn't good at science.
Yeah.
And so I stayed away from it for years. And it was only later in life after I freelanced for many years and that just became, I was a bad freelancer. there's a lot of hustle involved and it just wasn't, it didn't really suit me that well. So I was thinking about making a career change and I decided that I was a food writer for years and I wanted to go and get a master's in public health and study nutrition, which was, which was a slight pivot, but also related to the things that I care about.
Yeah.
And so I had to basically start over. I was going to community college and taking all these prereqs so that I could apply and so that I could take the GRE. So I was taking human anatomy and physiology and chemistry. And I realized at the age of 35 that I had been living with this idea that I was bad at science. And in fact, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I could actually be really good at it, and that I loved it. I was fascinated by it. I didn't know that that would happen necessarily. And I also realized, which I think I'm sure you know this, but for a lot of people, I mean, you don't make that connection that science is so relevant to daily life. Mm-hmm. And it informs so many things about our culture. And, you know, I came late to that. And I think that sense of curiosity and that excitement about it is part of the book. It's built into it.
I think it's really exciting that you had that opportunity. I think I had not a completely similar experience, but I was deathly afraid of science as well. And I didn't really find science until my master's degree. And I took a year off in between, so I went relatively straight through. But mm-hmm. I majored in psychology as an undergrad because I thought it would be easy. I didn't think I had to take much science, you know?
Yeah.
So through psychology, I found neuroscience, and I was lucky enough to have really good professors that kind of helped me realize how fascinating it was. So I switched to the biology department for my master's and did a neuroscience master's degree. But I do think that that experience, it's a very privileged experience, and B, a very common experience for those of us who have the privilege to do it. Because unfortunately, most young girls, and this is definitely a culture problem,
yeah,
are raised in an era where they're not meant to feel like they, sorry, that's Killer agreeing with me vehemently.
There's your child chiming in.
Exactly. He's like, this is so true, Mom. Keep talking about that. But yeah, we're raised in a culture where we are not pushed. Girls are, I mean, there's a whole lot here to unpack, but
definitely. It starts very young. Yeah.
Starts very young. The skinny of it that I've been talking about quite a lot recently is that we raise our boys and girls very, very differently. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's something I want to dive into with you, but we raise boys to pretend that nothing is too hard for them and to not be okay with failure and mm-hmm. just grin and bear it. We raise girls where it's okay to cry if something's really hard. It's okay to give up. It's okay to switch your gears. And so, of course, we get the shift early. And then, of course, teachers and parents and a lot of cultural figures, there's a lot of stereotype threat. We just don't have expectations on girls in the maths and sciences the way we do with boys. So they don't grow up thinking it's, you know, we're like, it's hard. It's hard for boys too, but they're not allowed to admit it.
Yeah.
It's a real problem, like, I mean, across the board.
On both sides. Yeah, no, I totally agree.
So are your kiddos boys or girls or both or neither?
I have two girls as far as, you know, I mean, they were born female, and we'll mm-hmm. see, you know, how it all unfolds. We didn't know. We decided both times, my husband and I, not to find out the sex of the babies.
Interesting.
And it's interesting because people really have a hard time with that when they ask me. One of the first questions is, so do you know what you're having?
And then you're like, a child.
You know, we'd say no. And then a lot of times the conversation would just stop. So I kind of came up with this stock answer, but I think it's true, which is that, well, you know, it's not really up to us anyway.
Yeah.
But I have two daughters, and it's something that I think a lot about, you know. And I also realize that it happens, you know, in school, the way we push kids away or don't push girls into science and mm-hmm. math more actively. But when you're young, I mean, and there's moments of this in the book where we begin teaching children really early on about the natural world. Like, we teach them about animals. We talk to them about, you know, the very hungry caterpillar that turns into a butterfly. And that's how we instill this sense of wonder in them. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking a lot about how I want to continue to cultivate that in my daughter. And eventually, I hope that grows into a love and appreciation for science. Whether she chooses to, you know, engage deeper in that, I don't know. But I want her to approach it that way, as opposed to being like, this is science and it's intimidating. Like, no, this is life. And we've been talking about this stuff since you came out.
Yeah. And like, this is science and it's some subject in school that's hard, like calculus, where it's like, no, 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 but this is science. And it's kind of the way that we approach every single thing in the mm-hmm. world. It's like a system that we use to understand what's going on around us. I bemoan that's the biggest problem, is that science is taught as a subject in school, as a standalone. And not as a system or process.
Mm-hmm. No, I like that. I haven't quite thought about it that way. Yeah.
But of course, you became fascinated by this system and by this process and all of the incredible things that you learn about pregnancy through mm-hmm. your personal journey. And you wanted to share that with both other people who may become pregnant, who are currently pregnant, but also maybe people like me who don't ever plan on being pregnant, but still am in awe of the crazy stuff that happens to our bodies when it's going on. So what is some of the stuff that you learned? Like, I would love kind of some highlights of things where you're like, are you freaking serious? I have to deal with this now, or I cannot believe this is happening inside of my body.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of it, well, I mean, the origin, the way I got to write the book in the first place was because I had a lot of questions about breast milk. And I was not interested in the conversation of breast milk versus formula, which unfortunately is the predominant cultural conversation. You know,
breast is best. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so I'm willing to accept that, you know, this thing that we've been evolving for hundreds of thousands of years, like that's not, you don't need to sell me on the idea that that's probably optimal nutrition. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it's, you know, like I'm glad that formula exists for people who don't want to breastfeed or who can't.
Yeah.
I was just like, so, but what is this substance? Like, what is it exactly? And that's probably, it was directly informed because I was working as a food writer at the time. So here I am, you know, eating food all the time, writing about food, thinking about food, and suddenly I'm producing food.
And so weird, like a plant.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like food was on my mind all the time. So I was interested. And I believe food is a reflection of our culture. You know, it's who we are as individuals with family backgrounds. You know, my parents are immigrants. So food is a very specific story in my life. And it's also clues about what we value. And so I was like, let me think about breast milk. I just was thinking about it all the time because it was a constant in my life. And so I also feel that, you know, women get a lot of pressure to breastfeed. And we are often told that immunologically it is better for the baby. Mm-hmm. So when I just asked, well, how exactly does that work? You know, my doctor, nurses, a lactation person, they couldn't tell me. Mm-hmm. And I needed to know more. Because also after, I think when I wrote it, my daughter was about 10 months and I was burnt out. And breastfeeding is a lot of work. It's physically taxing. And I was in many ways looking for a reason to keep going. And the great thing about being a journalist is you can just call someone up and ask them questions and they'll answer them.
Yeah.
So, and I got really lucky. I found a wonderful scientist named Katie Hind, who's an evolutionary biologist who studies mammalian milk. And we set up a Skype date and I just unloaded all these questions on her and she had a bunch of answers. And I was really blown away. I mean, some of the things that I learned about breast milk, you know, are that it has these sugars called oligosaccharides that are unique to human milk, which just that alone is fascinating to me. And they actually can't be broken down by an infant's very new digestive system. And those oligosaccharides exist to feed the microbes in a baby's digestive tract. So breast milk is already not keeping just a baby alive, but these organisms that help humans stay healthy.
Oh, interesting.
So
yeah.
Start with that. And breast milk, I mean, there's even more. You know, there's theories about how breast milk adjusts itself. This is my big question, you know, immunologically, how does it help? And what Katie told me was that there's research into, you know, something called the intraoral vacuum, which is created when an infant suckles at the nipple. And there's a vacuum that's created and some of that saliva is sucked into the nipple.
Oh, whoa. And
they believe that, so there's receptors in the mammary gland that interpret that saliva. And if they detect pathogens, then it can trigger the mother's body to produce antibodies.
What? That's crazy cool. Right.
Very, very cool. I mean, mind-blowing stuff.
But also makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Why else would our bodies be doing it, right? Like, when she told me this stuff, I was like, okay, so this information exists. Like, I could never have predicted that she would tell me this.
Yeah.
And then I thought, why don't people know this? Why isn't this widely known? And, I mean, there's a number of reasons. One, because we haven't valued female health enough that, you know, these studies are relatively new. And so in that case, while there's a lot of work being done, it tends to exist, you know, in academic journals, in labs, and it hasn't yet trickled down to the people who need and want this information the most, which are people like me, new mothers and parents. And, you know, I mean, this was just for a feature article that I was writing. I had no idea that I would eventually write a book, you know, so I just decided I wanted to put this in an article and I thought, wow, I think this is interesting. I think breastfeeding women will find this interesting, but I wanted to write an article that I thought would be interesting to anyone who was curious about the human body, to anyone who was really interested in female health and, you know, who believed that women's bodies are amazing, because that's what I think.
And hell yeah.
The really wild thing is I wrote this article, and I wrote it for an alt weekly in Seattle, which is where I was working at the time, a paper where Dan Savage, if you know who Dan Savage is,
of course,
he's one of the editors and one of the founders of the paper. You know, The Stranger is not a paper that is known for stories about motherhood. Mm-hmm. And the article went viral pretty much immediately. And to this day, it is the most read article in the paper's history. So
that's so cool.
It was extremely validating, you know, where I was like, oh, right. Okay. So it's not just me who wants to know this. It's not just me who thinks this is interesting. It's not just me who needs this information. And it confirmed for me that this is information that people want. So to go back to the original question, you know, it started with breast milk. And then my agent got in touch with me and said, you know, have you thought about turning this piece into a book? And I said, you know, honestly, I'm not totally sure I could write a whole book about breast milk. I'm not interested. Yeah. I don't know that I'm totally interested in the subject to sustain a book. And she said, well, do you have any other ideas, preferably related? And I said, well, yeah, actually, I have a mental list about 3 miles long of questions that came up about what was going on in my body when I was pregnant. And, you know, that predates like the birth of my daughter. I mean, I had 2 miscarriages and no one seemed adequately prepared to talk to me about that or offer any kind of scientific explanation for what happened. And that was,
even though it's so common.
You know, 20 to 25% of pregnancies, diagnosed known pregnancies, will end in a miscarriage. And why don't we talk about that? And so then I was also, you know, the other thing, and one of my favorite chapter to write in the book probably was the chapter about the placenta. Because here is an organ, an entirely new organ that you grow inside of another organ in your body alongside a new human being. And we don't talk about it. We don't know anything about it. And I had many, many questions about it. And so that was sort of where I started. And I learned so much about that. So, yeah, including that the way that a placenta grows in the human body, which is it has to establish a very, very deep connection with the maternal blood supply, deeper than any other primate, mm-hmm. any other mammal. And it's since they discovered how it grows, which includes, you know, basically shape-shifting and disguising, placental cells will disguise themselves as uterine cells. So to trick the uterus to letting it get in there. And also it secretes a substance that induces death in uterine cells. And after they made this discovery, they later found this mechanism in certain types of cancer, including breast cancer.
I was just about to say that sounds like it's using some of the same tools that cancer cells use.
Yeah, it totally does. And so, I mean, that's mind-blowing to me and it's kind of sinister and wild. But
also like a really good piece of evidence as to why we should probably be prioritizing or at least at the same level studying women's health. Like,
thank you. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah. Like, it's so crazy that historically it's always been this like side note. Like, oh yeah. And then the woman, I think I mentioned this on the show before, but I was at the gym the other day and I go to a private gym where I have a trainer. And they have this like this poster on the wall that says the skeletal system. And then it's like an image of, you know, like a drawing of a dude, mm-hmm. with like all of the muscles and where they go. And then next to it, the female skeletal system. I'm like, wait, why is that one not the male skeletal system?
Right. Right. I mean, it's the
French.
There's the, you know, this thing about the placenta, the implication is that if we understood more about how the placenta grows in a woman's body, we might understand more about how to prevent cancer. Like, don't
exactly.
we want to know that? Right?
In all people. Yes.
And I mean, so that's one specific, like, that's why there's a case to be made, like, it's urgent and we should prioritize this, right? And we're starting to see that, like, the National Institute of Child Health and Development is, you know, they have an ongoing placenta project. They're directing a lot of money towards research right now, which is great. But, you know, back up mm-hmm. and, you know, the standard, this is something that I learned when writing the placenta chapter, you know, the standard of what is normal and the standard of what a body is for centuries, it's a male body.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't until this, I found shocking. This is one of the things that blew my mind. It wasn't until 1993 that Congress passed a law called the Health Revitalization Act that required that if you receive money from the NIH to do clinical trials, which by the way is, most studies receive some federal funding. It's only in 1993 that we started requiring that you include women and minorities.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
That we could have like an entire drug on the market, plenty of them on the market, that have never even been tested on somebody
on half the population.
Yeah, on half the population, or more than half, because maybe not somebody of, you know, Latin or African origin, or like, it's just bananas.
Yeah.
That it's like, oh, this drug works really well on white men, so it probably works really well on everybody.
But it makes you see just like just what we're up against and just how that stuff is built into our understanding of what science and health is. So, I mean, to go back to the fact that, like, I don't have a background in science and I've always, you know, felt like, oh, maybe I'm not good at it. In the process of writing this book, I had to sort of confront, there's a responsibility to get things right, right? Of course.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so as someone, though, who, you know, who wasn't necessarily always comfortable with science, like, I felt this extra pressure to do that. But it was also really, you know, it was interesting to see just how I have been, I have personally, as someone who is a woman and a minority, I have been excluded at the most basic level from this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like we study what we value. And if we were only studying white male bodies, that sends a very strong message about what we value.
Oh, it's so true. And I mean, obviously that has historically been what we value as kind of human beings, at least in the scientific sort of structure, which, you know, is we're just now becoming aware. I mean, women have always been aware of this. That's like something that I always try to, it's so funny. I have guy friends who are like, man, like after all the Me Too stuff started happening, like, man, it's so crazy that this is all happening right now. It's like, what a crazy time. And I'm like, you realize this has always been happening. You just now know about it.
I mean, my feeling is I want to have a generous attitude, which is like, welcome.
Yeah.
Because we need everyone.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But we've been here. So welcome to wherever you're at. You know, like I might not have the time to like do this basic groundwork with you, like in background info, find someone who can take the time to do that with you. But like, cool. Now you're here. Where do we go from here?
Exactly. Kind of as a random aside, but one of the conferences that that I somewhat help organize, not too much, is the Nexus Conference, a New England Conference on Science and Skepticism, because it's connected to my other podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And this year, we're making a really concerted effort because the skeptic community does not have the best track record of inclusiveness. So we're obviously making a really concerted effort to have the best program we can possibly have. And I am going to be doing a panel. And the idea was to do something having to do with Me Too. And the more I was looking into the options, I was like, you know, I probably don't want to have this panel at a conference where I know most of the people who come are white men.
Yeah.
I don't want to have a panel that's like, you're disgusting. Here's how to be less disgusting.
Yeah.
So we decided to do a panel that's like, how to be an ally.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's such a hard situation right now. We all know that like the most obvious and I think most kind of easy way for us to react is like, yeah, welcome to the fucking party. Like, let me tell you what you've missed all these years. Don't be gross like these other guys have been gross.
Yeah.
But then you get this really reactive kind of like, no, that's not me. Let me double down and let me talk about men's rights. And that's problematic too. So
that's a conversation I don't have the time or
oh
the energy
gosh.
For. You know,
it's
I have a limited
so exhausting.
Amount, especially with a newborn, I have a limited amount of time, energy, and fucks to give in a day.
Seriously. Oh my gosh. You put that so well. And I do have a question for you because I think that something that I've noticed lately is that though there is a growing understanding of what is happening in a woman's body during pregnancy, you know, we're starting to understand more about the placenta. We're starting to understand more about like colostrum. We're starting to understand more about a vaginal birth versus a cesarean birth.
Mm-hmm.
That sect of the kind of, and this is my skeptical mindset coming in.
Yeah.
Of sort of the alternative medicine movement that takes some of that information, takes it to an extreme and then takes advantage of people with it, you know,
yeah.
is like, let me dry up your placenta so that you can eat it in pills and it's not FDA approved and there's no way to know if it's completely safe. But trust me, if you don't do this for your baby, you're a bad mother.
Yeah.
I think that's also really dangerous, is that pendulum swing kind of to the other side.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I agree with you. And I think that they are taking advantage of people. But I think, you know, we have to sort of trace it back, which is that, to get back to this idea of like the way that science has left out women and the way that we, in very recently, it's really in the last century that we have deeply medicalized pregnancy and childbirth. Mm-hmm. There have been advancements from that. And, you know, I'm someone who has had two C-sections and it's not what I set out to do, but I'm very, very grateful that I had them, you know? And so I bring the perspective of someone who I trust women. And I think that there's a lot that the medical community could learn just in terms of listening to women and knowledge that women who have been birthing children and who have been guiding birth for centuries there's a lot to learn, right, from that. But so I think that, you know, the extreme alternative medicine or alternative and quote unquote natural birth, which I hate mm-hmm. because I think all birth is natural.
Just because you take meds doesn't mean you're not naturally giving birth to a baby.
Right. And just because you have surgery, just because the baby doesn't come out of your vagina, like that doesn't mean that's unnatural.
Like your baby is now alive. So yay. You know what I mean? Like that's why you had surgery. So your baby would stay alive, mm-hmm. which is a good thing.
I think the pendulum swinging in that direction comes from the fact that that was trying to fill a void where people feel really let down. They feel really dismissed and they feel, you know, disrespected by the medical community.
So you're right. It's a reaction.
And the truth is that many of us fall somewhere in that middle ground. Many of us are like, I love the idea of having a home birth. Wow, I'm really glad that I was able to go to a hospital because things could have gone badly for me if I hadn't mm-hmm. had that, right? Like, the other thing is birth and pregnancy, it's a lie to say that you're totally prepared and you know how it's going to go. You never know how it's going to happen. And you should have everything at your disposal and you should have information and knowledge so that wouldn't we all just feel way more confident making decisions if we had access to information, you know, and not information that's sold as what is good or bad. Like, you know, one of the main arguments of my book is that we tend to frame pregnancy and motherhood in a moral framework, which is, like you said it, like bad mom, good mom, this is right, this is wrong. And we set everything up as being like a binary of choices. And it's really not like that. You know, what's right for you is not necessarily going to be right for someone else. And we'd stand in judgment a lot less of other people. And we'd stand in a place of confidence more ourselves if we had a more generous view of pregnancy and childbirth. There are many things that are true and there are many options. And I mean, the book really advocates for if we just presented information straight, a lot of this again is emerging science and emerging information that we is fairly new, you know, that we mm-hmm. only are just beginning to know because we're really only now just starting to value female health. But if we gave people access to this and we didn't present it in what's good or bad, if we just gave it to them, then they could take that stuff and make informed choices and feel good about that and know that they're making a choice that's right for them.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank a new sponsor this week. So exciting. And they are Jamf Now. That's Jamf Now. They help you set up, manage, and protect your Apple devices on demand. I am a massive Apple user and I have had issues in the past and I wish I knew about Jamf before. You know that you can kind of keep track of your own Mac, iPad, iPhone, whatever devices you have. But what about the other Apple devices in your business? As it grows, so does the collection of technology that you use. And it makes it harder and harder to manage everyone's iPad, iPhone, and Mac all at the same time, especially if your employees are in different locations, which is pretty common with technology companies nowadays. But with Jamf Now, you can check real-time inventory, you can configure Wi-Fi and email settings, you can deploy applications, protect data, hello, super important, and even lock or wipe a device from anywhere. Jamf Now manages and protects your devices so you can focus on your business instead, and you don't have to have, this is the best part, any IT experience. And you, the Talk Nerdy listeners, can start securing your business today, setting up your first three devices for free forever. And you can add more for just $2 a month per device. What an incredible deal. So I don't know why you're waiting. You should go right now to jamf.com/nerdy. That's jamf.com/nerdy. All right, let's get back to the show. It's something that I have seen more and more around, like, sort of the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. Like, it's funny that you mentioned that all of this was sort of launched out of a journalistic piece that you did around breast milk. Yeah. Because when I think of writings about breast milk online, all I think about is the breast is best argument. Yeah. And this sort of very judgmental, like, don't get a C-section, do everything you can do not to have a C-section because it's not going to be healthy for you and for your baby. And it's so sad that such a kind of life-affirming experience mm-hmm. might be riddled for many women with just a lot of guilt and shame and judgment because of just the way that we've really been, I think, culturally shaped to have, to pass judgment, to have commentary. I think a famous example was, gosh, I'm so not good at keeping up with like who's who in like public media, but some famous mom was at a show or at a sports thing, and she mentioned something about like pumping and dumping on her Instagram feed and got all this hate from people like breast milk is liquid gold and it's nature's, you know, medicine. And I can't believe you would just throw it in the trash. And she's like, whoa, people, this is my boob. Like, calm down. I can do whatever I want with my own boob. It hurts when they're really swollen and I'm not with my baby right now.
Yeah. It's hard to enter into these conversations because it's very fraught. And again, I think a lot of that judgment comes, I want to believe that most people don't really want to be judgmental or,
you know, no, I think it comes from a good place.
Yeah, I think it just comes from the fact that we don't support women. There are all these expectations. You can't win either way. Motherhood and pregnancy, the way we set it up, it's basically just a trap where you always feel inadequate. You know, like even if you breastfeed, like it's hard and it's tiring and you kind of want to quit, and then women feel guilty about that, right? Like, because we don't have things like family leave that allow women to have the time to breastfeed and be supported, right? Or like people who use formula don't feel supported, like they have to go back to work, and then people think that they're bad because it's really, if we actually supported women, then we would feel better. But I mean, that's a huge motivating part of the book. And in all aspects of pregnancy and motherhood, we really, I hate to say it, but we just fail women on nearly every front. And it's really hard to get out of the experience of pregnancy and childbirth without feeling terrible on some level.
Yeah. And then we like pathologize that and we're like, oh, but it's postpartum. It's this thing that's happening in your brain. And yes, there is a lot of good evidence to show that some aspects of postpartum are like purely biochemical, but there's a huge social component that contributes to that. A huge one. Yes. And like, can you imagine of course you can, but being at work and feeling like the only way you're able to breastfeed is either out in the open and get like openly ridiculed and shamed for it, or go to the bathroom because there's not a place to breastfeed. Like, I don't like to bring my water bottle into the bathroom with me. I would definitely not want to feed my child in the bathroom.
Yeah, we hide it. You know, we're not allowed to talk about the things that we're dealing with. And, you know, I was thinking about how, you know, like you go to an office and you hear about people's dogs, you hear about people, what they had for dinner last night, you hear about like in their television shows, you like all of these things are, you know, important aspects of people's lives. Well, if you're a mom or a parent, having a child is arguably one of the most important aspects of your life, and you should be allowed to talk about that. But somehow it seems like a burden. It's really,
or it's like so taboo because it's quote unquote gross. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what's that about?
Yeah.
Like, we can talk about your colon cancer, but we can't talk about the baby growing inside of you.
You're grossed out watching me breastfeed, but I'm watching the way you're putting that salad in your mouth and having all that pork, you know, and I'm not saying anything to you. You know, all I'm doing is feeding. My baby's just eating. You know, like, this is the most, this is a very normal thing. And it's life-sustaining work that I'm doing here. Like, step off.
I have to admit, like, I love, and I keep mentioning a good friend of mine, and I'm not going to say her name because I don't know if she wants to know about it or if she wants to be quote unquote outed on the show. But I just love that over the course, I've learned so much from her because of the two babies that she had really close together, just like you did. And it's so great that when I would go over to her house really soon after she gave birth, she just like pulls out her boob and is, you know, and then puts the baby on it. And it's like, there's no comment. She never, ever once has been like, oh, sorry, I have to. She doesn't apologize. She doesn't. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And it doesn't matter who's over, our girlfriends, our guy friends, our everybody, because like, you know, she's in a loving relationship. She has these children. It's not sexual.
No, it's what, it's just what needs to be done.
Yeah. And it's so important. And I have to say, I love that you kept using the phrase, we have failed women, because I think the saddest aspect of all of this, and it happens not just with pregnancy, but it happens with how, you know, young girls are not pushed or promoted to be interested in science and math. It happens across the board that it becomes so entrenched that we is the operative word because women themselves are a part of it. It's not just that men treat women this way. It becomes so institutionalized and it becomes so entrenched that even women flinch about other women breastfeeding. And that is a massive issue.
Yeah, it's really, it's, I mean, I think people side in the place that there's power and, you know, like, I mean, we could go to the election and like women who side with disgusting men because that's where power and value is. And we... you're rewarded for that. You know, like it's, we still see motherhood and these things as like niche. And I think even within feminism, feminism fails a lot of women still, you know, it fails a lot of women of color. It fails trans women. You know, we don't, we exclude people from these things. And it's not like I sold a book where I was like, I am going to write like the feminist book on pregnancy and motherhood. You know, I look back on it and now it's, I mean, this is just who I am. So it was always going to be a feminist book, but it's not something I specifically set out to do, but I realized that it's just this, my editor told me, like when I submitted the manuscript, I was like, huh, there's a little more of a political edge to this, in part because I was writing it right after the election. And once you start researching female reproductive health, I went to a really dark place because also like in terms of legislatively, like our personhood is really, it's very much up for debate. And so there was this, you know, there was a little bit more of a political undertone and edge to what I turned in because we were talking about repealing the ACA. We were talking about not guaranteeing maternity care, you know, Medicaid, which would mean like over 4 million people give birth in the US every year. 2 million of them are covered by Medicaid. So you're talking about taking away guaranteed care for half of the people who are having babies. So I turned in.
And that's just at the federal level because we're still seeing at the state's level abortion rights taken away. And like that's threatened. Roe v. Wade is threatened all the
time. And honestly, you know, around the country right now, abortion is inaccessible for many, many people, you know, and we're basically, so you basically force people into motherhood. And then after they become mothers, you tell them you're on your own.
Or even while they're pregnant with, then it's like, oh, by the way, we're not going to help support this at all. So good luck having a healthy baby.
I just laughed and I feel terrible that I just laughed because it's not funny.
No,
it's shameful.
That's how it
it's
is.
Very shameful.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I was writing this book, I mean, the feminist part of it came later. That was sort of the subtitle because my editor, after reading it, was like, you have such a strong point of view. And in the way that the moralizing tone of a lot of pregnancy literature, that's kind of what I was writing in response to. I wanted an alternative. Yeah. I wanted something else because, you know, those books are valuable. They still have information. It's just that the way the information presented is, again, in that moral framework that did not sit well with me, that I felt was like asking me to suspend the critical mind that I brought to like every other aspect of my life and the work that I do. She was saying, you know, that people might be turned off by that, the strong voice and perspective that's decidedly feminist that I have. And then, I mean, I love her for this because she was like, I was worried about it. But then as I kept reading, I just decided, yeah, I don't care, because it's about time that we have a book that explicitly comes from this point of view. And in, it's 2018. Why don't we have that yet?
And for every like one kind of fundamentalist type of woman who's turned off by reading something like this, I think that there are 20 more women who are so empowered who read something like this and feel like, fuck, finally, these things that I've been hoping and feeling deep inside, but like have not been corroborated. Like there's somebody here saying that I'm not crazy for thinking this
way. No, they're not alone. I'm not alone. And you know, the book's not out yet, but I've already been hearing from people. It's being received in exactly that way, which is exactly what I hoped for. You know, people feeling like, I feel really represented by this. I feel very seen by this. I feel all of these things that I was worried. It's just me who thinks this. Not. It's really not.
Yeah. And it's so funny too, because I don't know, I just had this thought flash across my head that there's so many women out there who do have a fundamentalist viewpoint, who are maybe a little bit, maybe not a little, but a lot more conservative or even, shall I say, regressive in some of their political views, and who actually happen to have the most experience with motherhood, because there is a high correlation between, you know, having lots and lots and lots of children and having fundamentalist religious views. And I so feel for the experience that they must have during all of these pregnancies and during all of these births, and just kind of, you know, the bondage that they may experience deep down of not having the sort of feminist support that I think a much more modern and progressive view offers to women. And it's sad. Like, I hope they read this book too.
I hope so too. I mean, I really tried to write a book that is welcoming to everyone, that sort of meets you where you're at. So if you're engaged and you, I mean, like, I definitely identify as a progressive, even like radical politically political person. But, you know, so I think if you're tuned into these issues, like, you'll find yourself there. These issues are being addressed. But if you are not there, maybe you'd read this and think about things in a different way, but you'd still be able to relate and see yourself and feel supported. Because I think it's really an issue of being of supporting women and validating their experiences. But I mean, I'll totally admit that, like, at one point in writing, you check in, like, who is this book for, right? Like, and I never try to write for this imagined audience. I think about, like, I'm writing it for me, for my people. I was really thinking about, this is the book that I wanted. This is the book that I think a lot of my friends want. But I imagined, you know, someone, a more conservative person, a white woman in the middle of America reading this. And you know, motherhood and pregnancy is a radically transformative, physically, emotionally, psychologically experience. And I think it's possible. Mm-hmm. It's possible. Many women, I think, can become, you know, radicalized and can evolve their views of the world through motherhood, because you're on the front lines of raising the next generation of people who are going to be making decisions. You know, I think a lot of us think about how, I mean, I definitely think I don't want my kids to inherit the shameful shit that I carried about my body for years, you know, that it took me years to find out as an adult, you know, like, I didn't know what my clitoris was until I was at least 14. And my daughter, who's 3, definitely knows what hers is, you know? And I think that, you know, we think of motherhood and having multiple children, especially, as being a very culturally traditional act, which in many ways it still is. But it's also the place where we can break from our most oppressive and our most limiting cultural traditions.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of times sort of multiculturalism, more progressive, like intersectional views come from having a strong sense of empathy. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when you live life in a privileged position, you aren't faced with experiences that require empathy as often as when you are struggling. And so I think you're absolutely right. There are probably plenty of women who are experiencing for their first time ever being on the receiving end of the kind of judgment and the kind of difficulty when they enter into pregnancy, and realizing, like, oh crap, our cultural relationship with pregnancy is not healthy for women.
Yeah.
Like I am experiencing it firsthand right now, and I think I want to see things change.
Yeah, and I hope that the book, like the book would come into their life, and instead of at a place where it's very easy because you're, in many ways, you're homebound more, you're inwardly focused, right? Instead of shrinking into that, I would hope that the book might come into their life and you know, inspire them to sort of step into motherhood and take hold of things, you know, and speak up because it's overdue. And again, feeling that they're not alone in this, there's many, many, I mean, it's, you know, to go back to what you were saying about Me Too, like there's an informal, I wouldn't call it a whisper network, but there's definitely like, if you become pregnant and become a mother, like this is a lot of stuff that, you know, we all talk about amongst ourselves, but it hasn't been really formalized or put in a book. And, you know, and my book is just, I hope that there's many more books like mine that come out because that's, you know, I don't know what I don't know. And I've done a lot of research and I wanted to be inclusive of a lot of different points of view, but you know, my story is limited and I want there to be more. I want us to be talking about this stuff more.
Yeah. And not just the personal narrative, but the science that you do bring into it, I think is so important because you do it from a perspective of a storyteller, which, you know, a lot of the pregnancy books that exist out there are like a little bit more dense. They're fact heavy. They're informational heavy. Yeah. And of course, knowledge is power, but it doesn't really have an effect if it never makes it through your skull because it's so numbingly boring or difficult to read. And so when you add it, you know, when you really talk about it in a cultural milieu, when you talk about it in a storytelling fashion, it just sinks in more. Mm-hmm. And when women know what's happening in their bodies, it's so incredibly empowering.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that was a big part of how I structured the book, you know, which is there's a lot of my own experience. And I never set out to write anything that's remotely like a memoir. You know, I used my personal experience less because I think everyone needs to know my story. I don't think that. I sort of put myself out there as like an emotional access point. And if a woman could relate to that in some way or be like, oh, that wasn't quite that way for me, but I remember, you know, having that gestational diabetes test, right? And if you can get to people emotionally in the way you do that, like, is you're right, totally, it's through stories. If you can get to people emotionally, it's easier then for them to slip into the science. And there's plenty there that I discovered. You know, that's my hope, that it resonates with people on an emotional level, and then it prepares them to receive that science and learn all of this stuff that maybe they didn't know that they were interested in, or they didn't think that they could get into or even understand.
Absolutely. I mean, I really do think it's at the core of, you know, what we do, which is journalism. And for me, more specifically, science communication. You're doing science communication in this book and in some of the journalism that you do. And I just think it's so important. And also speaking to what you said about writing to an audience that's really true to who you are. I think that's so important because it's the only way to be authentic. And the minute that our words lose their authenticity and how genuine they are, the minute we cannot engage anybody anymore. So yes, sometimes there are people who, you know, may not identify, but that's okay because I'd much rather have an effect on a smaller group of people, but have a profound effect than write something for everybody that's so vanilla that nobody even really cares about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, so far the reception for the book is, it's been more than I imagined, but I think it's also just because, you know, like I'm 40 years old. I've been like freelance and knocking out this writing life for a while. And I worked, you know, in local journalism and, you know, as a food writer and as a person of color, I've always sort of had this, a little bit of an outsider perspective. And I've been like, you know, and when you're writing a book, you're literally locked away in a room for like a year. So I'm like just happily toiling away in obscurity. Right? Like, and so I wasn't thinking so much about like, who am I going to reach and what exactly is going to happen? And it's cool to have people respond to it. I mean, that's really what it's all about. Like the best feedback I get is when people say like, you made me feel less alone. Right. And then the other element is also to be able to like, not to have people just relate, but also then to learn something that's so powerful. And I think the stuff that, you know, that's in this book, like a lot of the science is really, it's new. And one of the points that I want to make about the science in this book is that a lot of it is, we don't know. I mean, like the stuff about the placenta, like it potentially holds the key to learn about more about cancer. It holds the key to learn about organ transplantation because, you know, a mother's body tolerates this organ that is not, that is foreign. I mean, it's, it comes from the fetus. So it's 50% somebody else, you know, like, and yet her body tolerates that. And so if we can understand that, maybe we could understand how to like transplant an organ into people without having to suppress their immune system with so many, you know, pharmaceuticals, which is what normally has to be done to prevent rejection. Right.
Yeah.
And we haven't even talked about microchimerism yet, which is another whole chapter in the book, which is when you harbor the cells of someone who has different DNA in your body, which happens all the time in pregnancy. You know, we carry the cells of our children in our bodies for decades. And that's, we're only just beginning to see that that's common and that has potential effects. Like we're seeing that in terms of autoimmune disease and, you know, we're seeing how the cells of fetuses in women's bodies potentially, like they don't, they're not passive cells. Like they can grow to become neurons. They can become, they've been found in C-section scars, so they might help with healing. They've been found in breast tissue. Like all of this stuff is so new. And if we study this stuff, we have a lot to learn, not just about women's health, but about all of her health.
Absolutely. About how, you know, our bodies exist with our microbiomes, about our kind of defense systems. And, you know, we've known for some time that there are times when women's bodies will reject a fetus because of like a blood type problem. Yeah. But that's so rare compared to the amount of times that somehow a foreign body can grow inside of a woman. And like the fact that that it just doesn't seem like it should be possible, yet it is.
No, exactly.
So there's so much to learn from that. Yes. Well, gosh, Angela, I've learned so much from you already. There's so much more to learn. And of course, that comes from reading the book. But before we go, and I promise to have you out at a certain time because you are a busy, busy mom. But before we go, I would love to close out the episode by asking you the same two questions that I ask everyone on the show, because I think you're going to have a very, I don't know, informative, enlightening perspective. So if you're ready, they're kind of big picture. Okay. And they are sort of two sides of the same coin. The first question is, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now in kind of your mind, whether it's personal, it's global, number one, what is the thing that's really keeping you up the most at night? What are you most concerned about? Maybe a little bit pessimistic or cynical about. But on the flip side of that, what are you really actually quite hopeful for? Where does the cynicism wash away? And you get to say, legitimately, I am optimistic about this.
Well, I'm just going to answer with the first thing that pops into my head, which is late stage capitalism. And American capitalism keeps me up at night because it's not sustainable. And, you know, it relies on reproduction and producing people, right, to be consumers.
Yeah.
And so we rely on people for this economic system that we are all complicit in. Like the other part of the system that we don't talk about is that capitalism relies on domestic work, which is done overwhelmingly by women and expected for free. So
yeah,
that's just, like, I think about this stuff all the time. That's what it worries me, right? Because it has implications for a daily life. It's how do I reconcile like my participation in this system, right? Like, I go to Costco, in everything, right? Like we definitely like, no one's immune from this. And the thing that makes me hopeful though, is that I was able to write this book, that someone wanted to publish a feminist perspective on pregnancy and motherhood, and that this is starting to resonate with people, and that what we might begin to have a larger conversation and to shift things. Like, I don't know, like, I don't necessarily believe that this stuff is going to change in my lifetime, but I'm raising these, I'm raising my daughters to be thinking about these issues and to know that, you know, domestic work is work and it has a real value. And we need to support the people who are doing that work and support the people that are supplying and making the people that keep our system going.
And if they are doing it, they'd better be doing it by choice, because otherwise that is slavery.
Yes.
And that's a really important point to make, that slavery in modern times takes a lot of different forms. And I think that we need to use those words because they have power. Yeah.
I mean, and when you say that, I just think about how we should all go read Octavia Butler now. Like, you know, we should all go read the Earthseed trilogy, which talks about a lot of this stuff. And I think she was, I mean, this is going off right at the end here, but I mean, so much of what she wrote is like, I think that she was a prophet in many ways about like, you know, her books are set in this future and they deal directly with slavery. And it's all very relevant to what we were just talking about. So,
Angela, this has been such a fascinating, I think such an important conversation and in many ways really unexpected. So I have to thank you for joining me today. It was, it was just really enlightening and a ton of fun. Guys, her book is Like a Mother, A Feminist Journey Through the Science and Culture of Pregnancy. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you so much for having me and for having this conversation with me.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.